I call this House Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order. Let it be known that we have quorum. Welcome everyone today to today's hearing. Before we get started, if I could look for approval of the March 18th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. So we will move into our first item on the agenda. Representative Rerar, we are going to do an informational hearing on your House File 4234.
Thank you so much, Chair Igo. Ready for testimony?
All right. You are good to go.
So this is a tax-exempt bonding bill. Affordable housing is super complex, and most projects must use many, many different sources of funding to complete a project. And one piece of that puzzle is that every state gets a set amount of federal tax-exempt bonds. The federal low-income housing tax credit is the main way federal government funds affordable housing. Federal law dictates how a project becomes eligible for these tax credits. And last year, federal legislation, HF1, lowered the amount of tax-exempt bonds a project would need in order to be eligible for the low-income housing tax credits. This bill would align us with that change. The end result is that more projects will get a tax-exempt bond allocation because the pool of money is able to be spread across more projects, which means, in turn, more projects will be eligible for the tax credits, and therefore, House File 4234, when enacted, will create and preserve more affordable housing in Minnesota without any additional state funds. The Greater Minnesota Housing Fund had discussions with developers in the fall. They believe it is beneficial because ultimately it's better to have more projects get done. Also, MMB, HFA, developers, and the chairs of our housing committees are all in support of this bill, and we have not yet heard of opposition. We believe there is unanimity within the housing community around the benefits of making this change. I want to thank the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and the Family Housing Fund for working on this proposal prior to session and for aligning the various interests around the bill we have in front of us today. So with your permission, Chair Igo, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Tingerthal. I served for 8 years as the commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Also have worked with the low-income housing tax credit for more years than I would like to care to admit. I am here today working with the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, which was mentioned by Representative Rerauer, which is the largest housing-focused community development financial institution in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. As was mentioned, the low-income housing tax credit program is now 40 years old, created by the Tax Act of 1986. It has been, ever since then, the primary tool for getting affordable housing built in the U.S., with over 4 million properties having been either developed or redeveloped over the last 40 years. In July of last year, H.R. 1, otherwise known as the Big Beautiful Bill, amended Section 42 of the tax code to include a number of changes. A simple change was that they did increase a little bit the amount of so-called 9% credits, which typically will pay for about 70% of the cost of a property. Not a lot, but there was some. The second type of tax credit is called the 4% tax credit, and that typically will fund about 30% of the project costs. That's only if a project chooses to go in and competitively receive an allocation of tax-exempt private activity bonds. Each state sets up its own process for how private activity bonds are awarded, And I would say that Minnesota perhaps has the most complicated statute of all states for how these bonds get awarded. But the ones that I'm here to talk about today is approximately $350 million worth of bonds that are allocated through a process, a standard process, that's administered by MMB. And the last time that the section, which is 474A, was amended, MMB made some changes, and we have consulted with them about making this change, and they are supportive. While there is no limit on the amount of 4% tax credits that can be allocated within a state, there is a limit, as Representative Rehrauer mentioned, on the amount of private activity bonds. So the fact that H.R. 1 said it used to be that you had to allocate at least 50% of your project costs to being financed by tax-exempt bonds, what H.R. 1 did was said, no, you can only use, you may use as low as 25% of your project costs in tax-exempt bonds, and you can get an allocation of 4% tax credits, which allows you to raise enough equity capital to cover 30% of your project. So that's a pretty big deal. In thinking about talking with you today, I went and looked at some numbers from last year, and I'm pleased to say that we think that this simple change made by this bill will probably bring an additional $120 million in tax credit equity into this state every year. What that means in terms of number of projects is that there were about 14 projects done last year. In an average year, we've been able to do about 15 projects. With this change, we are likely to be able to do 24 projects a year. So going from 15 to 24 by making this simple change. What this does is it sets a cap, which used to be at 55% when the federal law was 50. The cap now is set at 30% unless you are going to use a fair number of the bonds for permanent financing, in which case it would be 40%. A little bit complicated, I will admit, but after speaking with a wide range of developers, nonprofit developers, for-profit developers, they said, really, it's important that we make room for a range of different kinds of projects that are going to be financed by these bonds. And oftentimes, those are projects that have deeper income targeting or allow us to preserve older projects. So the two things that all developers agreed on was that 474A should be amended to put this lower cap so that the bonds can go further, and it should also be done this year. This is our first opportunity after the passage of H.R. 1. However, the implementation in the bill is delayed until January 1st of next year, which is really the next time that people are likely to apply for these bonds. That way, developers that may have been working on a project for a number of years, because sometimes projects are in the waiting list for several years, people will be able to modify their projects between now and the first of the year so that they can successfully submit a new successful application. So those are the two things, the implementation first of next year, a more restrictive cap. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions people may have, but this does reflect five organizations, the Twin Cities Housing Alliance, which is largely a group of for-profit developers, the Housing Stability Coalition, which is largely a group of nonprofit developers, as well as the Minnesota Housing Partnership, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and the Family Housing Fund. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll go into member discussion. Members, who's first on my list? Co-Chair Howard.
Thank you, Representative Rehrauer, for bringing this bill forward. It is a highly technical bill, but I really appreciate former Commissioner Tingerhall for talking about the impact that could come. And, you know, I don't get too many chances to say anything nice about the big, awful bill in the federal government. But this is a change that does make sense that we should conform to, and we should do it this year. I couldn't agree more. So glad we're able to do a hearing on the bill today and hope that we can stick with it throughout the session, get this across the finish line because it's important. And we know that dollars are stretched, and anything we can do to stretch them further, we ought to take advantage of and pull every lever we have. And so thank you to the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Family Housing Fund, and all the conversations that's happening to lead us to have a bill that has a lot of consensus and people think is the right direction. So very supportive.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I'll make a few comments as well. No, I mean, looking into this again, it's very highly technical. It's kind of hard to read, but the big stuff that stuck out in your testimony is how we're going to grow, how many projects we get done, and the amount of investment it brings. But the thing that makes me like it the most has to be the fact that it's going to increase public-private partnerships to build out housing in Minnesota. And that's, I think, what's key. We've talked in this committee a lot about how we need to attract more equity partners into the state of Minnesota. Well, the federal government just gave us a cookie to do that. So it's on us as the state now to adopt this and get it done. So I'm glad we're having this informational hearing here in the House. And now let's just hope we can get something moving in taxes. So if members, let's talk to our tax folks on that and get this one.
Yes.
So that's all the further comments I have. Seeing no further discussion from members of the committee, Representative Rehrau with any closing comments.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I just want to ditto on your comments. Would love anyone to recommend that this be heard in taxes. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. Moving to the next item on the agenda, we're going to have House File 484, Representative Mecklen, if you want to make your way to the front.
Chair Igo, did you say 484?
Yes, 484. Since you're a member of the committee, I'll let you make the motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would make a motion to move 484 to the general register.
The bill is before us. Please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually have two of them that are very similar, so you might be a little repetition in here. But bottom line is I've had these bills for like 8 years now. I'm kind of proud of that one. And what this comes down to, especially in a time when there is already a significant risk in the grid stability right now, and actually there's a lot of rural Minnesota homes that don't even have access to the infrastructure. Like you get into older homes, they wouldn't even have ample power supply coming to their home without having to do a complete new drop and an upgrade, converting very expensive equipment, all this. So what this gets at is a prohibiting banning natural gas in a residential home. We've been seeing this. 28 states have already passed language like this. I believe that maintaining energy choice means greater resilience. There was actually a time after there was a propane shortage a few years back. We'll get to that in a minute if he might remember that. But after that, they actually were putting forth mandating dual choice or dual fuels in homes. So if one became unavailable, there was a backup way to heat. And that is actually where this derived from like 8 years ago. So there is some stuff in your packet, and I do have a testify here with me, Mr. Wagger, who is the executive director of Minnesota Petroleum Association. And his testimony goes to both bills, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and start with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Igo and members. My name is Dave Wager. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association. Minnesota Propane Association strongly supports House File 484 and the upcoming 483. These bills protect a fundamental right, the ability for Minnesotans to choose the energy source that best meets their needs for safety, reliability, and security, to ensure local government cannot take that choice away. The legislation is not about promoting one energy source. It is about preventing a mandate. It ensures no single energy source is imposed in Minnesota households and businesses, because one-size-fits-all energy policy does not work in our state. mandating a single energy source introduces real risk. When that system fails, and we know all systems do fail, the consequences are not theoretical. In Minnesota, they can be severe, especially during extreme winter conditions where reliability is tied to safety and survival. The warnings are clear. Hopefully you guys got handouts in your packets. A recent assessment by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation identifies a high risk of future power outages in Minnesota. This latest report shows the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator region, which includes our state, faces growing reliability challenges as demand increases and power plants retire. As Rural Minnesota Electric Association President and CEO Derek Moe stated, we think the report is a serious indication that we need to keep an eye on the way the grid continues to evolve. As early as 2028, we could be seeing problems meeting our electricity needs. He also previously stated, in a state like Minnesota, having reliable power during dangerously cold weather can mean life or death. This is why energy choice matters. Energy choice means resiliency, a reliable supply and a backup when the primary system fails. Propane provides that reliability because it's stored on site and independent of the grid. When the power goes out, families still need heat, food needs preservation, and medical equipment needs to operate. Businesses must continue and homes must remain safe. A second energy source is not a convenience, it is a safeguard. As mentioned by Representative Mecklen, 28 states have already enacted energy choice in the law in the United States. Minnesota should not fall behind. Energy choice is about reliability, resiliency, and protecting Minnesota families. So thank you, Chair Igo, and thank you, Representative Mecklen, Representative Lawrence, for authoring these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Wager. All right, we'll move into member discussion. Co-Chair Howard.
Thank you, Co-Chair Igo, Representative Mecklen. I know we heard these bills last year in committee, and some of our members voiced some concerns, you know, and have named that there aren't any cities that are presently doing this. And so, you know, we still have those same concerns. So, you know, I know we're at the end of deadline week, but this isn't something that, I'll be supporting today.
Thank you, Co-Chair Howard. You know, I just want to make some comments. The reason, and we did a good hearing on this bill last year, the reason we have the bill in front of us again today along with the next one is there's been some developments on this discussion as a state. I know the PUC is starting to have some discussions about banning natural gas, propane development in greenfield developments. And I found it in direct contradiction with a lot of the work that this committee's been doing on land use and zoning. So we need to make sure that we have energy freedom, like was said by the testifier, energy choice by our constituents, by the people of Minnesota who are not only fighting to be able to choose the kind of homes they want, but we should also be able to make sure they can choose the kind of energy they want to use in their homes. So that's all I have, but I'll go to Representative Mecklen for any closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Igo. I think it's important to point out, if you were in the Energy Committee, you would have all known this, but because Patty Aikum enjoys the fact that I actually bought an air source heat pump a few years ago, which, you know, it works up until a point until it gets a certain temperature outside, and then it has to switch over from the gas. But interestingly enough, this year, last fall or winter, the electric side stopped working. So if we didn't have propane out there, we would have no source of heat whatsoever. And that is the whole point of dual fuel. So are we just voice voting this out?
There's no roll call requested.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Nash.
I'll ask for a roll call.
Seeing a request for roll call, there will be a roll call.
Very good. I'll re-renew my motion to send 484 to the General Register.
Representative Mecklen moves that House File 484 move to the General Register. A roll call being requested. Betsy will take the roll. And the chair votes aye.
Chair Igo, aye. Co-Chair Howard.
No.
Vice Chair Dotseth.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Buck.
No.
Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Momani Hiltzley, no.
Representative Myers.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Norris. Representative Rehrauer.
No.
Representative Scraba.
Aye.
Representative Norris.
With 6 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. The bill will be laid over. Representative Mecklen, we'll move on to your next bill if you want to move your next bill in front of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 483, I move to the General Register as well.
To your bill.
Thank you, Chair Igo. This is a very, very similar bill, with the exception that the other one dealt solely with residential buildings. This one deals with all buildings that can't be told you can't have it and you can't be forced to have it. It was, and it's the same, almost identical to everything else, unless you want to really hear all that. We can, you know, if you had want anything to add, but it's pretty much the same testimony. So it's really what it comes down to is giving people the choices and options, because like I said, not every place has the ability to be all one. And I think it's a very important thing to take into account, as well as the efficiencies on larger buildings are much different than they are on smaller buildings. So go to member questions if there are any.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen. Yes, this is a very similar bill. Is there any? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I thought I'd speak on this. While I agree gas is the best way to heat, it's the most efficient, it's the most effective way to heat. The push to electricity when we don't have the grid doesn't make sense, but at the same time, it still boils down to the fact that we're taking the ability away from our communities to decide what their communities want. And that's why essentially I had to vote no last time. That's why I'm voting no this time, just because the consistency of that. It's this communities that should be making these choices. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any other members wish to make any comments or discussion on the bill? I'll make some closing comments. The reason, and this bill is just, like I said, very similar to Representative Mecklen. The big one that I want to talk about is how this involves propane. This is predominantly going to be talking about districts in greater Minnesota, such as myself, where you talked a lot about dual source heat. Where I live, when it's going to be negative 40 for 3 days in a row, and that propane tank is emptying quick, and they're running trucks to try and keep me filled, it's important that I still have that option to have other sources like propane, like electric, to make sure that my house doesn't freeze out, because that would not be a fun time. So with that, I'll go to you, Representative Mecklen, for closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Igo. There was a poll that was done a while back that it's like some crazy number, like 67% of all people prefer to cook on natural gas or propane. Tell you, if you want to tell, if the local government wanted to tell my better half that she had to give up on her gas range, it wouldn't go well. And I don't, to Representative Johnson's statements, the interesting part is this is not taking away local control. I mean, it is in a sense, but since when does the government tell you what appliances you have to have, what kind of vehicles you have to drive, what kind of power source you must use? If that's the kind of government that you're supporting, I want no part of that. But anyway, are we roll calling this one? Or are we going to, we're going to roll call this one too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I do need a formal request for roll call if we're going to have one.
I would request a roll call.
Representative Nash requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. With that, we will move to the vote. Betsy will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Chair Igo, aye. Chair Howard?
No.
Vice Chair Dotseth?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kozlowski?
No.
Representative Buck?
No.
Representative Hussein?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Mecklen?
Yes.
Representative Momani Hiltzley?
Momani Hiltzley, aye. Oh, sorry. No.
Run with that. Dang it, I thought I had one.
No one. Run with it. Run with it.
Representative Momani Hiltzley?
Representative Momani Hiltzley, no.
Representative Myers.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Norris. Representative Rehrauer.
No.
Representative Scraba.
Aye.
Representative Norris.
With 6 ayes and 7 nays, the bill does not prevail and will be laid over by the committee.
Just so you all know, that'll make it 9 years next year when I bring it back again.
Well, hopefully third time's the charm, Representative Mecklen, because now we have House File 2614. If you would like to move House File 2614 to the committee.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair Igo. Yes, House File 2614, I would like to move to the General Register.
That is your motion, and Representative Mecklen, your bill is in front of the committee. Please begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Igo. So this bill is also it's the exact same section that is in the HOA bill floating around. I don't know if he's here. League of Minnesota Cities did put forth a letter over there. Last time we heard this in the last stop it was in, and they were neutral. So what this, the purpose of this is to not allow a zoning and building department to order them to put in an amendment that forces an HOA. In the last committee, there was a lot of conversation about storm retention ponds by one member that through the conversation about water runoff and all that, it was interesting because it was a concern about cost, but nothing prevents the city at that point to have hire a professional company that does that rather than have the HOA do it and then assess the neighborhood for the cost by the divided by the number of homes. So that was the one issue that she had with cost. But we have, I don't know, you want to, I have Mark Foster here with Housing First that will be testifying as well. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Foster. I'm the Vice President of Legislative and Political Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. Housing First Minnesota is a trade association representing nearly 1,000 members across the housing industry, and our mission is to advance home ownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. Our members are the builders and developers who serve as declarants of homeowners associations, HOAs, and are responsible for the creation and establishment of those HOAs and new residential developments. We want to thank Representative Mecklen for this bill. He's worked on this one not as long as 8 or 9 years, just a couple years, but and we appreciate his the language before you today was where we landed late last session on the Senate side. So it's been discussed in prior hearings and within the HOA working group that this started in that more than 80% of new home construction in Minnesota is part of a homeowners association. And as the declarants who create these associations, we believe that number is way too high. So we must right-size the use of HOAs moving forward. But let me say first that the HOAs do serve an important and appropriate role in certain types of housing. Villa products designed for low maintenance living, communities with shared amenities such as clubhouses and pools, and townhomes with shared walls and roofs all require an HOA structure, and that should and will continue under this this legislation. However, outside of these housing types, many home buyers are not seeking to live in an HOA, and our members would often prefer not to create them. Too frequently, the formation of common property and consequently an HOA is driven by local government regulations, sometimes with the expectation that the HOA will own or maintain infrastructure that would otherwise be public. In these cases, home buyers are paying twice, increasing local property taxes and unnecessary HOA dues. Home buyers bear the cost of this dynamic, and ongoing HOA dues increase monthly housing expenses and reduce purchasing power, limiting how many Minnesotans can achieve home ownership. At a time when our state faces both a housing shortage and an affordability crisis, we need to focus on building more homes, not creating more unnecessary HOAs. Under current state law, the creation of HOAs will continue to be created when they are necessary. This proposal changes none of that, and they will continue to be formed where they are appropriate and essential. All this legislation does is address the loopholes that allow local governments to effectively mandate HOAs by requiring unnecessary common property. By closing these loopholes, this bill will reduce the number of HOAs created in new construction and support housing affordability across the state. So this legislation is one of a small number of meaningful, practical proposals to address housing supply and affordability, and we believe it represents a thoughtful, targeted reform that can make a real difference for future home buyers across the state. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Frost. We'll move into member discussion. First, my list will be Co-Chair Howard.
Representative Mecklen, third time's the charm for me on this one. Members, we've heard a version of this multiple times. It was also included in the Starter Home Act, and we've worked really closely on this legislation. So it's an opportunity to send this bill to General Register. And so appreciate your work on it and the broad work that's going on HOA reform as well. I know that's still moving as well, and I'm very supportive of that, but happy to move this standalone along the process.
Seeing no further discussion, I'll make a few closing comments. I'll concur with my co-chair and thank you for the work, Representative Mecklen, on this. This provision's had a lot of work done over the last couple of years, but it's one of those things that it's returning freedom and choice back to the buyers of Minnesota who want homes and they want them the way they can have them. So with that, Representative Mecklen, I'll leave it to you for closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Igo. You know, there's a lot of work that went in this over the last almost 2 years, and Representative Nash and I he's been a big advocate for a lot of these different types of things. We did work with League of Minnesota Cities, you know, because they had some concerns. We found some common ground here. I appreciate it all. I renew my motion for 2614 to the General Register.
Representative Mecklen re-renews his motion that House File 2614 be moved to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Members, that concludes our bills on the agenda today, but next we're going to have a presentation from the manufactured home industry. If they'd like to make their way to the front of the room for the presentation, Co-North will be first on my agenda.
I have a PowerPoint presentation, and I wasn't sure if I could use the screens or.
Yes, just give us a moment here. We'll get them turned on.
There you go. Should be okay. On the screens now. Great.
Look at that. There we go.
Let's hope it shows the right screen. Oops. I believe it does.
Well, if you're ready to go, please introduce yourself for the record and could proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Igo, Co-Chair Howard, and the committee members. I'm Emily Stewart. I'm the Associate Director of Co-North, formerly North Country Cooperative Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to share insights on the state of manufactured housing in Minnesota and the role of our organization and the way that we preserve this critical source of affordable housing and home ownership. There are 8 members of this committee with 3,943 manufactured housing units within their districts, underscoring that manufactured housing is not only a niche issue, but a critical component of affordable home ownership across Minnesota. So Co-North, formerly NCF, is a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul dedicated to expanding cooperative ownership and economic opportunity. Since the early 2000s, we focused on helping residents of manufactured home communities, commonly referred to as mobile home parks, purchase the land beneath their homes and convert those communities into resident-owned cooperatives. In addition to cooperative development, we provide ongoing advising and coaching to ensure these communities thrive, helping residents with governance, management, and financial stability. In 2023, we created a loan fund to provide mission-driven, low-interest lending solutions to our partner cooperatives, And we've also recently launched a manufactured home dealership so that we can ensure our cooperatives have access to high-quality factory-built homes. Since 2004, we've helped 18 communities, 15 in Minnesota, transition to cooperative ownership. We also serve Wisconsin. Through this work, we've gained a deep, deep understanding of what it takes to permanently preserve these communities and the challenges that they face. With legislators' support, we've been able to make significant progress in building a strong set of tools to protect these communities for the long term. Manufactured housing is Minnesota's largest source of naturally occurring affordable homeownership, serving over 180,000 residents. For many, it's the only pathway to owning your home. While there are many misconceptions about manufactured communities, the reality is most residents, about 87%, actually own their home. The only thing that residents in those communities rent is the land underneath those homes. New manufactured homes not only are also cost-effective, energy efficient, and durable, while costing half as much, if less, to construct than site-built homes. Preserving these communities is also highly cost-effective, with infrastructure rehab averaging about $10,000 to $50,000 per unit, far less than affordable housing solutions in other sectors. Manufactured housing is found all across the state. As I mentioned, you all represent about 4,000 units across the state just here in this committee alone. And that serves a diverse population that otherwise struggle to find affordable homeownership opportunities. 75% of residents in our partner cooperatives earn less than 60% of AMI, and 40% are households of color. So historically, manufactured home communities were locally owned and operated. Many were developed by small business owners who lived on site or nearby and were invested in by the well-being of the residents and the property. Over time, investors have identified this as an opportunity to profit from these communities. Investors have found that they can raise the land rent without substantially reinvesting in the infrastructure. In fact, Bloomberg did a report that MHCs were the fastest appreciating commercial real estate asset over self-storage and industrial from the period of 2010 to 2020. It appreciated by 478%. I'm going to repeat that number again. It appreciated by 478% over this 10-year period. How does commercial real estate appreciate in value? Based on the revenue that it generates, not by the any material improvement to its infrastructure. While that is essential, and there are so many folks that are doing that, both resident-owned and locally-owned, I just want to point this out, that this investors have seen this as an opportunity and they've capitalized on this. So when this happens, homeowners have little choice but to pay the increasing rents when investors get involved because they are looking to increase this and then sell it and revolve it in the speculative market, even when roads, water, and sewer systems are neglected. In investor-owned communities, lot rents typically rise by about 6% per year. And in some investor-owned communities, it's much, much more. In resident-owned cooperatives, we typically see about 2% per year. I just want to underscore this. Local owners are not who the problem is here. The problem is corporate landlords that are buying these properties and revolving them. These are out-of-state folks that are seeing this as a speculative asset. In resident-owned communities, homeowners collectively own the land through the cooperative. That's how our work works. The land goes towards running, or land rent goes to running the community at cost, paying their mortgage, and making the needed improvements. Most importantly, resident ownership means stability. There's no risk of a sudden sale or displacement, ensuring these communities remain a permanent source of affordable housing, and even in sometimes, folks' homes can appreciate and value themselves. Many manufactured home communities rely on aging, privately owned infrastructure, water, sewer, roads, and electrical systems, most of which were built in the 1950s and 60s, with about a shelf life of about 60 years. So you know where we're at in that shelf life, right? We're at 2026 rather, and so we're hitting that peak. So without investment, these failing systems put entire communities at risk. Recognizing this urgent need, the legislator established the Manufactured Home Community Redevelopment Program, the MHCR program, which since 2020, the program has awarded $44 million in grants to both privately owned and resident-owned communities. This has been an essential lifeline to manufactured home communities and to preservation writ large. As an example, this community is in Co-Chair Howard's district. This is Woodlawn Terrace. They converted to resident ownership in 2020. And I'll also just mention that Co-Chair Igo and Representative Johnson both have communities that have received MHCR grants. Co-Chair Igo, Midway Park and Grand Rapids received funding, as well as Cedar Terrace and Stillwater. So for Woodlawn Terrace, it's a 50-unit community in Richfield. They completed a $1.7 million infrastructure rehab project with MHCR grant funding, and the project included sanitary sewer repairs, road repaving, and a transition from private well to municipal water. This is a huge upgrade. As you can see, their water on the right is what they were drinking, what was coming out of their taps before, and what's coming out of their taps now is drinkable. Drinkable water is a huge issue in so many manufactured home communities, and the MHCR program is helping folks get that drinkable water, that potable water, back into their homes. Minnesota cannot afford to scale back on investments in manufactured home infrastructure. There's too much at stake, and demand continues to grow. Thankfully, Minnesota has an existing program that can be leveraged to expand access to infrastructure improvements. You've already advocated for $15 million in appropriations to the MHCR program, but we can always see a larger base appropriation go here so that we're not relying on HIBs allocations. A major challenge for manufactured housing is the rising cost of homes and the lack of affordable financing. In the last 10 years, the cost to build a new manufactured home has more than doubled. While it's still affordable, between $100,000 to $150,000. So I don't know if you've looked on Zillow recently, but I don't think you're seeing many homes that are brand new and around $100,000 to $150,000. So this is still an incredibly affordable asset. But because manufactured homes are on leased land and titled as personal property, they don't qualify for traditional 30-year mortgages or most down payment assistance programs. Instead, buyers are left with personal property loans, which have shorter terms and higher interest rates. Recognizing this gap, the state legislature took an important step in 2023 by appropriating $10 million to develop an innovative manufactured home loan product with our partnership, who I'll just talk about in a second, with NeighborWorks Home Partners. This is a huge deal. Minnesota is only the second state in the country to recognize this important investment, the first of which was a program that was based out of New Hampshire called the Welcome Home Loan Program. So NeighborWorks Home Partners worked with New Hampshire Community Loan Fund to create this really innovative and amazing product that can be used by any homeowner that's looking to buy a manufactured home on leased land in the state. This has been an incredible investment and an incredible opportunity for home buyers across the state to be able to attain homeownership through manufactured housing. Manufacturers' homes on leased land are legally treated as personal property, as I mentioned before, and this classification also blocks access to traditional markets. Homeowners are pushed into higher interest chattel loans with fewer consumer protections. The results are higher monthly costs, reduced wealth building, and limited refinancing options. Title reform aligns with legal framework with how manufactured homes actually function. Permanent housing. Manufactured title reform will unlock lower cost Fannie and Freddie mortgage products, so expanding the market, and will strengthen housing stability without new ongoing stability. Let us know if you'd like to be part of the legislative working group on manufactured home title reform, which is active and ongoing. The final issue I want to highlight is something I mentioned earlier when I mentioned the appreciation of 478%. I just want to say that again because it's a lot. I want to highlight the rapid shift in ownership landscape of manufactured home communities. Since 2015, out-of-state investors have acquired nearly 30% of the state's manufactured housing stock, purchasing 142 communities, and that represents about 13,500 homes. These are families. These are folks that call these homes where they've lived for generations. These are homes that are being destabilized by the transactions that are occurring in this market. I want to highlight two. There's been two private equity deals. One, Zenith Terrace in Duluth, sold for $44 million. I will highlight this. That was a cash deal that was $11 million over market evaluation by Haven Park. And in 2021, Brandon Dallas Eats in Chaska, another 493 lots, homeowners, was sold to Haven Park for $40 million, nearly double of what that property's appraised value is. The impact on the residents is destabilization and potential economic eviction through these rising rents. In the Brandondale sale, it happened in 2021. Residents have experienced a 65% lot rent increase. The significant portion of these acquisitions have been made by private equity firms, which have a track record of driving up land rent, often by double digits, and deferring critical infrastructure improvements. To make matters worse, federally backed entities are fueling these acquisitions. In Minnesota, 2/3 of the private equity purchases were financed by Fannie and Freddie. Seeing the urgency, the legislature took bold action in 2023 by appropriating $10 million to a revolving acquisition fund that is now held by the Co-North Loan Fund. We've now used the $9 million from that state appropriation that was in lending capital, leveraged it for an additional $4 million, and we've now deployed $6.7 million of that with an anticipated deployment of another $6 million this year. And to date, we've preserved 360 home sites, and we know that that will double with the deployment from this year alone. The loans that we're able to give out here is on average 4%, well below market, and all of that interest is revolving in perpetuity to continue to fund acquisitions by residents to keep this affordable housing locally owned, locally controlled by its residents. In fall of 2024, we are notified that for the foreseeable future, Minnesota Housing was offering acquisition financing, which was an incredibly innovative product, and we hope that they will come back to this market because it is so essential. Since when Minnesota Housing stepped out, we then went to local lenders, and I am very happy to share that with your state investment, we've been able to leverage an additional $3 million from local banks and local credit unions that have participated with our low-interest capital to help fuel this preserving of manufactured housing through resident ownership. This is fast-acting capital, and it means better terms and better results for folks that are selling their communities. Local owners. We love working with local owners, and we love seeing the opportunity for preservation for resident ownership. The legislature also passed a notice of sale law in 2023, which required community owners to notify Minnesota Housing and the community's residents when they're considering a sale. You've also been a part of a 5% tax credit, which was passed for community owners to sell to co-ops, nonprofits, or municipal buyers. The intent of these laws were to give preservation-minded buyers a chance to compete when communities are for sale and to provide an incentive for owners to sell to nonprofit entities. But unfortunately, since the notice of sale law went into effect, Minnesota Housing has only received 8 notices that have actually gone to sale, and we know from the Department of Commerce's website there's been 42 sales since the law went into effect up until December of this past December. So 8 notices, 42 sales. There's not enough teeth in this law, and this is just us reporting back data that we're seeing from the effectivity of the interventions the legislature has seen fit to put into the market. But luckily, that notice has also allowed us one sale, Lone Oak Estates in Cannon Falls, and we are thrilled that they have entered into resident ownership as of December of this year. It's clear that additional awareness and enforcement are necessary to ensure these laws achieve their intended results. Sorry, I'm just looking at my notes. Thank you again for your time today. I know that I have spent a lot of time talking to you about manufactured housing. I'm sure manufactured housing might not have been on your mind prior to this meeting, but I appreciate the time and attention that you take to this matter.
Well, thank you for your time. Ms. Stewart, I believe, did I have one more testifier from Co-North that was maybe going to be in tandem with you today, or is it just yourself?
I think it's
yourself?
Just me. Thank you for asking.
So I know we have one more presenter, but is there any member discussion before I move on to our next testifier? Representative Mamani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair, for the opportunity to ask a quick question. In regards to, can you talk about the tension between manufactured homes as home ownership and as assets for as a commercial real estate asset for park owners, and why that matters to public policy?
Thank you for asking that question. This is a really unique situation. This is one of the most unique situations in housing and in just ownership in general. There's two classes of ownership that we're dealing with right here: folks that own their homes and folks that own the park, right? This is a really important tension. And I think what we're seeing, what's happening around the country, is folks are intervening to better understand how they can balance the rights of homeowners with park owners, because that balance is necessary to recognize both voices in this process. The voice of a park owner and the voice of a homeowner has a place in this conversation around preservation, around affordable housing. When I talk about how the speculative market has taken manufactured home parks, they have really turned this into an asset class, right? That's a different conversation than affordable housing. And so when you take affordable housing and you talk about how it can be appreciated in value simply by to benefit folks that are not in the self-interest of preserving that as affordable housing, homeowners need additional protection. So we're seeing a lot of intervention from different states around the country around this. And I think in resident ownership, we see this as a natural opportunity for homeowners to be able to preserve their homeownership opportunity in perpetuity. So thank you.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you, Chair.
Next on my list will be Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I know that the conversation around these has been that the folks who own the home but not the land, they'd like to own the land. Oftentimes, the rent is very difficult for them to achieve, so they buy these, they become a co-op. So my question is this, having been a homeowner and been a mayor and seeing things that happen, what happens if there's infrastructural failure? How do these folks accrue capital for that? Without a grant program from the state, because we don't know where this budget is heading for the future. So how does that happen in a situation like this? Because I'm just not seeing it, and maybe you can illuminate me on that.
So when
Ms. Stewart.
Thank you. So when I first started at CoNorth, I was called a business and technical assistance provider, which means that I provided direct technical assistance to communities that have chosen to convert to resident ownership. It'll address your question. I just wanted to provide some of that context. So every year, as their business advisor, I come and help the board put together an annual budget. That budget includes property management, that their property taxes, their property, anything that you could think of between snow plowing, landscaping, all the operating costs. And then they have debt service. And that debt service then goes to pay their mortgage lender to make sure that they can continue to finance the park. But they also put in money every month into a replacement reserve. And that replacement reserve is there as a savings bank for the cooperative to address these infrastructure issues that are happening in their community. They are good stewards of the communities that they have inherited, but they have also inherited a system that typically has not been invested in, because of the astronomical prices of the way that these are many cities, water, sewer, and roads. And without that ongoing investment, it's become a bear for them to take on. And so the MHCR program is really designed for deferred infrastructure and maintenance so that these problems don't perpetuate. And resident-owned communities in particular are ones that steward these resources the best, because not only are they investing in their own infrastructure, but then annually they're getting their sewer cleanings because their lenders and their as community owners are making sure that they know that that proactive investment is going to benefit in perpetuity, because they are going to own it in perpetuity. There's a consistency in ownership where that infrastructure is not passed on to the next person, but they're continuing to foster it and to nurture it, because they know that they're going to have to foot the bill in the end.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up again, without a government grant, how are they going to keep up with this? Because if there's a catastrophic failure of sewer or water supply lines or roads, how do you sufficiently accrue that when you have rent control effectively or ownership, self-imposed rent control? I don't see the math, so I'm just trying to figure that out.
Sure.
Ms. Stewart.
Thank you. Historically, before the MHCR program existed, our resident-owned communities relied on capital traditionally from CDFIs. We have a national CDFI that we work with, Rock Capital, as well as local CDFIs, including our own now CoNorth Loan Fund. They all have products for communities to be able to finance these repairs over time. And I expect that private park owners also have those means to be able to go to banks and take on additional debt service. So those critical infrastructure repairs can be financed over time, and the landowner, whether they're the residents or a local owner, can continue to bear that through incremental increases of their rent over time. But our communities have been able to achieve this with an average of a 2% lock rent increase annually, where prior to 2020, with the establishment of MHCR, they had to finance their infrastructure repairs.
Any follow-up? Next witness will be Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Director or?
Associate Director.
Associate Director. You had talked about two properties, $44 million, $40 million. And I felt like you kind of glossed over if they could have the prop, you know, if they could get that property. Or why are these properties selling? And what is the solution other than going in and taking the private market and not making it the private market anymore? So what is the solution that you have?
Ms. Stewart.
Thank you. This is a delicate dance that I think a lot of states are grappling with. I will say that there are a number of bills up this year that are very similar to bills that we've seen across the country that are simply trying to give the homeowners mm-hmm. a balancing act to a leg up so that they can be on equal footing than the park owner. But I just also want to mention, so I know there's Isaiah has introduced the Homeowners Bill of Rights, which includes opportunity to purchase. And I just really want to clarify this for the entire committee, that this is really not about creating a preferential treatment for residents, but simply about allowing them the opportunity to be part of the transaction if they choose to purchase it. And so if the park is selling for $44 million and the notice goes out, it's up to the residents to see if they can assemble a financing stack under the current opportunity to purchase bill that's being proposed. It is not about dictating whether the park owner has to go with the resident offer or not. It is simply an opportunity for them to have a voice at the table. I know there's other legislatures this year that have looked to Maine, who recently passed a bill that was an assessment on any private equity firm that's looking to purchase a park. They are assessed a value per lot that they're paying on top to the state that then funds a similar type MHCR program where the state doesn't have to continue to allocate funds to the MHCR program or that thereof, but is actually being financed by the folks that are coming in from out of state and purchasing these parks for as part of their portfolio. So I'm not saying that these are the right answers, mm-hmm. but I think you're asking the right question. And I would say the answer is in trying to find how to balance the homeowner right with the owner, the park owner's rights, which are both equally important.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. And fundamentally, I kind of look down on the developer that's going to kick the people out because they want that property. It's that important to them. And I look at communities like, where, what are we going to do as a community? So maybe rather than us making that final decision at the legislature, can't the local zoning board or the local council say, are these 200 people worth fighting for or 200 homes sites worth fighting for? Or is it let c'est la vie, the market runs its course and let it go? At some point, because I sit on capital investments, there's no way a city of 3,000 can pay $9 million for a wastewater treatment plant. But we demand a wastewater treatment plant. So the state helps so that we can keep those communities whole and we make sure that that works. I'm kind of, I think we're all flirting around, how do we get to that point where we look at a community of 200 that's for sale for $40 million? Is it worth saving? Is it worth, how do we as a community agree that this is worth it? I mean, That's where I'm at now, and maybe I've not been here long enough to understand the whole thing, but it just seems to me that at some point we're going to have to deal with it because, well, not even deal with it. I think we should deal with it and say yes or no. That's where I'm at.
Thank you for the. Oh,
yep, Ms. Stewart.
Thank you for the question. So there's a larger conversation about middle housing. And I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but it's simply where is the opportunity for folks to achieve homeownership, to achieve stability, to achieve that sort of base level, I know where I'm living consistently and I know how to control for my expenses so that all of these other things can blossom in my life. And so my question, and manufactured housing is a very essential part of this middle housing solution. So my first reaction to your question is what we've heard from city and county officials is that preservation of manufactured housing is essential to them because they do not have a social safety net that is large enough to absorb the amount of folks that would then no longer have the ability to be housed or to be able to access the market that exists in those local communities. In fact, we have cities and counties coming to ask us how we can develop new manufactured home communities in their cities because affordable home ownership at $100,000 to $150,000 for that home is an achievable home ownership opportunity and now paired with that 30-year mortgage product that you all helped develop. And I want to just quickly tell you one story. And it's a story of a gentleman that I met when I was first starting out at Co-North. And he lives in a resident-owned community and is actually the vice president of the board there. He's lived there for over a decade. And this gentleman was homeless. He was homeless for almost 5 years, and he had a friend. They owned a manufactured home in this community, and they said, we have a room for rent. We need a little bit of help with our expenses, and we know you can afford this. So he went in, and he began renting the room. And then they got an opportunity to buy what's typically called a stick-built home in the community. And they said, would you like to buy this home? He is now a homeowner in this community, in this park. He is now a vice president of the board and is incredibly active. And I know that that's just one story, but it's a really important story for, I think, everyone to understand is a lot of folks that are living in manufactured homes are one step out to being unhoused. And what does that mean for that person to feel that instability through the jeopardization of their land lease existence through some out-of-state investor that might increase the rents to the point where they can no longer afford it? They're not sure where they're going to go next. But manufactured housing can also be that opportunity for somebody to take a step up into a stick-built home also. So preservation can look a lot of different ways. It can look like continuing supporting local ownership, nonprofit ownership, and resident ownership. It can look a lot of different ways, and I defer to the legislature to determine how they want to proceed in that manner. But I do not think that not preserving manufactured housing is an option, and I know that I'm getting that reinforced by my conversations at the city and the county level.
Next on my list will be Vice Chair Dotseff.
Thank you, Chair Eagle, for the testifier. You had mentioned maybe I misunderstood it, but you had mentioned something about your manufacturing homes or selling homes. Can you enlighten me a little bit more about that?
Yes.
Ms. Stewart.
Thank you for the question. This year, actually it was last year, we have stood up a subsidiary to our organization where we are a manufactured home dealer. And that might sound like a strange term, but in the state of Minnesota, manufactured homes are actually titled through the Department of Motor Vehicles. And so when they are sold through what's called a dealership. We prefer the term retailer. So Co-North Homes is now a subsidiary of our organization where we have franchise agreements with local manufacturing plants across the state where we can place manufactured homes in resident-owned communities. We have over 100 vacant sites across our 15 communities across Minnesota, and we're working with our co-op communities to place homes on spec or on speculation to then be sold to future home buyers. We have, I believe it's 7 on the market right now, and we're continue to buy manufactured homes across the state and place them in towns as far as Alexandria, Fridley, Minnesota, in Clarks Grove, Minnesota. And these are homeownership opportunities with land tenure that's secured because they are resident owned. So this is an exciting opportunity. There's also a homeownership course that was created through the Homeownership Center. I would encourage everyone to check that out if you want to learn more about manufactured housing. It's an online course that they created. And this homeownership course paired with this 30-year mortgage product that, again, could be used by in concert with our dealership, but any dealership, not just the mortgage product could be used with any dealership in any community. But Arco North Homes exclusively works with our resident-owned communities.
Vice Chair Dotsoff.
Just to follow up on that, so are they offered at a discounted rate, or are they are you in competition with the free market with what you're doing?
We're Ms. Stewart. I'll get used to this eventually. We are selling manufactured homes on the ARPIT market. We are selling them at cost.
Vice Chair Dotsoff.
Thank you for your feedback there on that. I appreciate that. I think we have to be really careful. This could be a slippery slope as we move forward, being in direct competition with the fair market and the open market as well. I'm just cautious on where we're going with this. I think you had mentioned that everyone's one step away from being unhoused within a manufactured house. I think all of us as taxpayers are that way if we don't pay our property taxes as well in the state of Minnesota. So we've got to be careful where we're going all the way around here. So thank you.
Next on my list will be Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Igo. I have a question going back to possibly even touch on the Bill of Rights. One of the things is my understanding with the private equities are doing to the manufacturing home what they did to the HVAC community, what they've done to contractors. They come in and their idea is they come in and spend and pay more than anybody else is able to pay, willing to pay. And then the idea is once they come in, they raise the prices significantly, whether it's furnaces, whether it's bathrooms, whatever you want to do. That is their business plan, and that's how they do it. So my question is, I know in the Bill of Rights it's you wanted the first right of refusal, but how realistic is that if a private equity comes in and spends 4 to 5 times what the market rate is, with the understanding the rents will go up 10, 11%, whatever, to support that? How would a community go and, if they're able to find the money, be able to spend that and not do the same thing in order to meet the mortgage?
Ms. Stewart.
Great question. As I mentioned earlier, there's been 42 sales of manufactured homes since the notice of sale law went into effect. That's 42 transactions of manufactured home parks across the state. Not all of those went to private equity. And what we're seeing in what we call OTP states is residents are just asking for an opportunity to be a seat at the table. And typically, these transactions are being done by local owners, and they don't always know that residents are an option to purchase their communities. We do aggressive market outreach as much as we can, but sometimes we don't get the park owner at the right time. To address your question on private equity, I do not believe that opportunity to purchase is an intervention to, I think it's a first step in a tools of toolbox to address the level of transactions that are happening on an annual basis of parks being able to be sold. And I think residents are interested in being able to have a seat at the table. Can they assemble $44 million? They sure as heck want to try. And I think the bill is just asking them, asking for an opportunity to try to assemble that type of financing. But there's, again, other sales here that are not $44 million, that are closer to $2 to $5 million annually, that might be more achievable for residents to be able to purchase that land underneath their homes. There's 180,000 residents that live in manufactured homes across the state in 800 parks. So, yes, it would be great to be able to compete with private equity here. And I think opportunity to purchase could be a step in that. But again, I'm only here as an expert testifier talking about manufactured housing. We are not necessarily supportive of opportunity to purchase. It's simply what we have seen in other states. It's certainly a tool in the toolbox for states to be able to use to promote resident ownership, rights against the park owner rights.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
All right, next panelist will be Co-Chair Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Ritt, for the presentation and giving us a lot to chew on and some really important data. I was really struck by the slide on the out-of-state speculation. And I'm curious, and especially that in 2025, that 85% of the sales are, out of state. And I guess first a comment, not in this committee, but in other committees, it often shows up in taxes committee. We often have the discussion about whether wealth is coming in or out of our state. And then a lot of folks, this can be complicated data when it comes to taxes and who are the people here, who are not here, but pretty universally, I think folks ascribe to the notion it's a good idea if wealth is staying in the state of Minnesota. So if you ascribe to that it's a good idea for wealth to stay inside the state of Minnesota, this slide should scare the crap out of you. With 85% of the manufactured homes being purchased by these out-of-state large private equity investors in these non-Minnesota buyers, it's a problem. And one thing I'm curious about is we've seen an escalation or a greater percentage lately of non-MN buyers. Have we also seen just an escalation of the sales in general over the last few years? I see the data from 2015, but I'm just curious if you have thoughts on really looking, even like 23, 24. Is it really, would a curve kind of look like this?
Ms. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yes, I think nationally we've seen that trend, and it is no change here in Minnesota. We have certainly seen an increase in sales in the amount of times a park transacts.
Thank you. Again, I really appreciate the presentation, and I really appreciated the questions by Representative Scraba and Representative Johnson that sort of speak to this tension. We've had a lot of conversations about putting more freedom in the hands of Minnesotans to set their own destiny. Yeah, sorry, Representative Nash. it feels like to the extent that there is a balance, when you look at slides like this, we have imbalance. And I really appreciate the way entities like CoNorth and others are doing to move towards balance and put more power in the hands of Minnesotans. And the reality is that manufactured housing is the largest source of home ownership in the state of Minnesota. And there's been a lot of bipartisan work over the last several years to value manufactured housing as a form of home ownership. And so I think this, your presentation and that work, I think, should continue. And I'm just grateful. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further, Representative Rerar. Oh, no, I didn't see you. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was on the list, so thank you for letting me go. The question was raised earlier, should we fight for these 200 households? I think the answer is yes, and we should do so at the state level. We have the ability to pass laws for the entire state, and this is a statewide problem. Now, I don't think we can level the playing field, but I think we at least have to give these residents notice of when the game is happening and unlock the door and let them into the game. So as you mentioned in your testimony, we've seen manufactured housing communities appreciate dramatically. So could you just clearly just take a minute to lay out for me why this is happening, how the communities are valued, and how that directly affects the lot rents?
Ms. Stewart.
So most people have experience with home ownership when it comes to what we call a stick-built home, a home that's affixed to a property that you own the land and you own the home. And when you change your HVAC system, or you know when you do an improvement on that home, that your home appreciates in value. And there's a material change to that appreciated value that you could get with your home sale into the future. We're not talking about stick-built homes when we talk about manufactured housing, particularly when we're talking about manufactured housing parks, because of the bifurcation of home ownership versus land ownership. And so that land ownership is a commercial real estate asset. And in the commercial real estate asset market, commercial real estate assets are valued based on the revenue that it can generate. And so while park owners might do improvements to the park, their appreciative value is not going to increase based on those improvements. Their value is only going to increase as they increase land rents. And so where I think speculative buyers from out of state, what we call kind of corporate landlords, are seeing an opportunity is there is a lack of regulation in this market writ large. There's also a lot of disparate entities that regulate manufactured housing. And because of that, they see that there might not be as much oversight as how much infrastructure needs there are in a manufactured home community. So they know that they can own a property for a short period of time, increase land rents during that time, and then the value of that park would go from maybe $1 million to $5 million without much material investment. And that's, again, I am characterizing out-of-state corporate landlords. Local owners are partnering with the residents of their communities to make sure that this continues to stay affordable housing. When we're talking about out-of-state speculative buyers, we're talking about people that are taking advantage of a market insecurity, right? You are the only people that can help rectify that, because otherwise they're going to keep taking advantage of this loophole where they can just increase land rents and then churn that transactional, which again goes to Co-Chair Howard's point where we've seen more and more transactions occurring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any follow-up? Well, thank you for your presentation today, Ms. Stewart, and for the deep dive in the information and data to us. Again, it's helpful to all of us members as we continue to work on this issue and hear about it here at the Capitol. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And then next on my list will be the Manufacturing Modular Home Association. Mr. LeBeau, you're already up there. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue with the testimony.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Reed LeBeau. I represent the MMHA. Mark Bruner couldn't be here today, so I'm filling in. I have my presentation down to about 45 minutes, so I hope that'll be okay with everybody. I'm going to go fairly quick, but I wanted to just off the top say, I know I've been sitting here the whole time. I agree with about 30% of what has been said up to this point, but I'm not going to try to go point by point on everything. I do want to give you just an overview of our industry generally. We represent the manufacturers of manufactured homes. We represent the park owners, and we represent the sales centers. It is true that you have to have, you can't just go to the plant and buy a manufactured home. You have to go through a sales center to make that transaction, which I myself learned the hard way about 8 years ago. The average cost of a manufactured home, they vary widely. But you can get a manufactured home somewhere in the high $60,000s to low $70,000 range. The $100,000 that you heard earlier, I think that's a little bit on the top end. You can add to it, and really the sky's the limit for what you want to spend on a home. But they can be significantly cheaper. We run generally about 20 to 40% more cost effective than a stick-built home in an area. We have 16 plants in the state, 4 that make manufactured homes, 12 that make modular homes. For those of you that are not familiar with the difference, the only real difference you need to know is that a manufactured home is built to the federal building code and a modular home is built to the state building code. We employ 800 employees in the plants that actually make these, and I was asked to invite the committee at its leisure sometime in the interim. We'd love to have you out to a plant and take you in and let you see how they're actually put together. I was never good at shop class, but it is something that's quite remarkable if you'd like to actually watch these things be made. The quality with which they're made is just second to none. We have 900 privately owned manufactured home parks in the state of Minnesota. That's 900. I know the co-ops had mentioned there are 15 co-op parks in the state. That's compared to the 900 that we have throughout the state, with roughly 45,000 families that are spread throughout the state. And I would agree with the slide that shows that the population distribution is more outstate than it is in-state. Most people are surprised to know that 85% of the manufactured homes that are sold in the state actually go on private land. So I buy it, I put it on an acre that I own, it actually becomes legally affixed to the real estate, and I can take a traditional mortgage out on that home. It's the other 15% that go into the land lease communities that I think was sort of the bulk of the previous presentation. But that roughly represents about 15% of all manufactured homes within the state. It was said, I can't remember if it was in this committee or in the other body, the unfortunate comment was made that, well, the park owners just own the dirt underneath. I wanted to clarify and put on the record that dirt underneath has a name. It's real estate. That is a very valuable property. It's not just dirt floating around. I mean, that is one of the most fundamental property rights that has been recognized throughout the history of this country and others. Of the 900 parks that we have owners that are multi-generational family owners that I can tell you take enormous pride in the parks that their grandpa started, that their dad ran, and now they've taken over. They put a lot of time and effort into not only keeping the parks in excellent condition, but also making sure that the families that rely on them for housing are well taken care of. There are challenges that we face. Probably the most significant challenge that the 900 private parks face are the rising costs of just overhead. Water consumption continues to be one of the single biggest drivers of cost for manufactured home communities, because the water that comes in is priced differently by different municipalities. Some of them treat us just like we're a commercial user, whereas in your house, you're given a different water rate because it's for domestic consumption. I think it was said earlier that of the cost increases that owners have been seeing over the last 5 to 6 years, it's run somewhere from 12 to 18% in some communities. I did want to address the point was made earlier about, so what's driving these property costs? I can tell you specifically in the metro area, I mean, you have to look at where the parks are. Parks are located in what was years ago the outskirts of town, and now the metro area has grown up around it. I think of the parks down the road from me. I live in Andover, and when I go down Highway 10, there's parks in the Coon Rapids area. There's parks over in the Blaine area. That property is significantly more valuable now than it was 80 years ago when the park was located there. That's one of the major cost drivers of why the land is going up in price. And I think that's one of the tensions that you see is as we are trying to maintain the communities, it's also a tension of those property values. So those are some of the challenges that we really face. Another thing is we're looking at really the issue of supply and demand. When you talk about, I think it was mentioned here earlier, new park development has been extremely low for quite some time. There aren't municipalities throughout the state that are zoning for new manufactured home parks. And so we're trying to protect a resource that we're not making more of. Just like we're not making more real estate, we're also not making a lot more new parks and bringing more parks online. And so that's a challenge that we've had. We don't get a zone. We don't get a zone wherever we want. You know, we have to work with local partners to make sure that that actually comes about. I think it's incumbent upon me to correct the record on a few things, because we did, I personally, along with Representative Norris, worked very hard on the current state of the law regarding the notifications. I don't think the previous testifier was suggesting that. She mentioned that there were 42 transactions of sales, 8 of which were posted. There are exemptions within the law on whether a certain type of transaction has to be posted or not. I don't think she was saying that there were 42 illegal transactions, but it may well be that of those transactions, they did not require the notice to be posted. But that was something that we worked on, and it went, I think it was passed in 23, finally went into effect in 24, and we'd like more time to see how that law actually works. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. I see the hour is late, so I don't want to belabor the point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
Well, thank you for your quick presentation on your side of the industry. Is there any member questions or comments? Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Igo.
There you go. Thank you, Chair Igo. And Mr. LeBeau, good to see you. You mentioned that the notice of sale requirements that we did work on together, and you know, the exemptions that we put in there were relatively narrow, and so, you know, I'd be surprised if, you know, 42 minus 8, well, that's 34 of the 42 sales fell within those exemptions. But I guess I'm curious, you know, as an association, does the association inform its members that they must comply with the notice of unsolicited sale requirements and that the 5% tax credit is available for sales to the residents?
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norris, I appreciate that question. We committed to you when we agreed to that law that we would do that. And I can tell you, I've been to every association meeting. We have 2 a year, and we've done that every single time. And we do think that it's a good process. It was an innovative process, and we'd like to see it continue to work. I would point out, too, and I understand, and I think we understand the basis behind the current bill dealing with the tenants' rights. I would say the problem that you're trying to solve for, or the problem that advocates for that are trying to solve for, is related to a very small number of transactions that are occurring, and we keep hearing about out-of-state participants. What I want to drive home, and I hope you remember, is that we have 900 privately owned parks in the state. That law is not limited to just those few people that are coming into the state to buy it. That law would apply to all of those 900 privately owned parks, and it would be, in our opinion, a very significant challenge for them the way that the bill is currently written.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Igo. And you know, I guess one of the things that concerns me is that we're seeing the rent trends expand beyond just the private equity owned parks. And when you've got a private equity owned park that is increasing rents by $100, that creates a permission structure and allows the market to bear then $100 rent increases in an adjacent park that may be owned by a local private owner of the park. And so, you know, I guess what we're seeing is a concerning trend across the board, not just limited to private equity. I'm concerned about the role that private equity plays in driving the trend. But, you know, I think it's something that goes beyond just that, just the private equity, and does call for a bigger, broader response.
Beautiful. Co-Chair Howard, I almost said Co-Chair Norris. I was going to give you a promotion.
thanks for the presentation. Question, just in terms of your membership, you know, and you mentioned a lot about the kind of the mom and pops and whatnot, but do these large, once an out-of-state investor comes and they're headquartered somewhere else, but are they part of your membership, your organization, those owners?
In all honesty, I've not looked at the, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. You think I'd know that by now at this point. Chair Igo, Co-Chair Howard, I will get back to you on that. I have not looked at the membership list, so I don't want to certify to you one way or the other who is and is not a member. They are not required to be members of the association. And I will say this is kind of a little esoteric manufactured housing fact. A law that we put into place many, many years ago, well, it's probably not all that long ago, but I want to say 8 years ago or so, was really aimed at trying to have better compliance amongst park owners for understanding like landlord-tenant and being able to come to our association meetings and learn those different things. And that's why there is a different tax structure that's currently in place, so that if they come to the meetings, they certify that they've taken certain trainings, they get a break on property tax rates. That doesn't apply to everybody if they don't actually go through those steps to get the information on, you know, whether it's updated landlord-tenant laws, whether it's the information on the sales and the 5%. So.
Coach Howard.
I would be interested in that information. Yeah. And, you know, the other question just about the current law related to notice, I would also be so as an organization, just curious your interaction with the existing law. As an organization, are you sending information out to park owners so they're aware of it? Is this largely left on park owners to complete their notice of sale? What's been that like on your end as an organization?
Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am only aware of what I've witnessed at different events. What else is being done to drive that message out, I couldn't speak to. But again, I'd be happy to follow up.
Coach Howard.
So the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association doesn't send out information about this law that passed and how to comply, that kind of thing?
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Howard, I didn't say that. No, the association does send out regular communications to the membership. I just don't know exactly what they said and when it would have been said.
Okay. Co-Chair Howard.
Curious, you'd mentioned, because this number, this statistic is very troubling to me too, that the only 8 notices we're aware of against 42 sales, and you mentioned that there's some sort of exemptions. You know, does your organization, are you able to provide, you know, more information about, I would just be curious how many of those are exemptions and how many are places that, in fact, did not follow the law. I mean, if we have a law and any number of folks aren't following it, that's a problem, isn't it?
Mr. LeBeau.
Co-Chair Howard, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Howard, I would not presume, just based on those numbers, to assume that there were 42 illegal transactions that occurred. I'd need to know the specifics of what those were. I assume that they're not, I assume that they are not accusing somebody of not following the law and committing a crime.
Would you presume that all of that delta of 32 were all exempted?
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair, without actual evidence of what occurred, I wouldn't speculate, but I certainly wouldn't assume at the outset that something not legal had taken place.
I'll just say that the numbers, what they are, just detail with, as a matter of fact, that the law is not working. When you have 42 sales and only 8 notices, and the data that I have is in 7 of those 8 instances, there was already a purchase agreement in place before the notice even went out. So the numbers are pretty clear. And just the lack of information from the association that represents those about what's occurring, you know, it just makes it more clear to me than was even before this hearing how much Reps and Norris bill is important that we pass.
Well, I'll just say a little chair prerogative there. I think on that last topic we were talking about, one of the points that I think we've heard a lot about when we talk about manufactured housing, when we talk about manufactured housing parks, is a lot of times they're family generational parks. And I think those wouldn't necessarily apply, if I would go back and look at the statute, to that right of notice, right? If you're selling to family, I don't think that was one of the conditions. So we can look into that. But I think that probably makes up for a lot of those ones, and it sounds like we're going to get that data, so we'll get into that. But one of the things, Mr. LeBoy, I heard in your presentation is the rising costs, and I think that I've tried to bring that conversation into the Housing Committee when we talk about things, that the decisions that we make outside the Housing Committee and at the state, at the legislature as a whole, are affecting an industry. I mean, when you talk about the manufactured housing industry, it's not to compare it to the three-tier system, but it kind of is, right? We have our those who are building it, we have the retailers, and then we have those that are providing the homes. And when there is levers being pulled that are affecting costs in all three different parts of those things, they have to trickle down somewhere. And I think the best way to support our most affordable way to home ownership and the way to give people a leg up is that when we talk about decisions around energy policy, when we talk about things around tax code, when we talk about things around energy code, those all trickle down to even the most affordable types of housing, and that is manufactured housing. So if we want to do our best to sustain manufactured home parks, sustain that level of home ownership, then it's on us as the legislators in this room that when we leave the Housing Committee and we go to our different committees and we go to the House floor to make votes on things, we remember that those decisions, when they increase costs, go down to hurt those that we're trying to protect in this committee. So, Mr. Bull, thank you for your presentation, giving your side of the story. Also, again, thanks to Ms. Stewart for her side of the presentation as well. It was a good understanding for this committee to learn more about one of the most important parts of affordable housing in the state. Thank you. So with that, members, that concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.